Celeb Savant is a career retrospective type interview focusing on singers, actors, and industry experts. Join Barrett Edelstein now as he dives into the entertainment world.
Michael Cristiano is an Australian multi-instrumentalist, singer, songwriter, and producer. As a child and teenager, he learned to play many instruments in genres such as rock, fusion, jazz, and many more. In the mid-80s, he joined highly respected show band Coco, playing guitar and fronting the band as its lead singer. This led to many engagements, playing with the leading Australian and international touring acts of the day, including Helen Shapiro, Johnny Ray, The Coasters, The Platters, The Drifters, and again, many more. His particular talents were in high demand by many touring acts, and he worked as musical director for numerous international and local artists, eventually gaining the prestigious role of musical director for Australian legends, The Seekers. In the mid-90s, he teamed up with country music star and close friend Donna Fisk as Fisk and Christian, and together they wrote, recorded, and released three albums, spawning numerous hits, and earning them a swag of industry awards, including Vocal Duo of the Year, Album of the Year, and Artist of the Year. In 1998, they had a chart-topping hit with their song Lara, and rocketed into the ARIA charts with their self-penned Australian Football League anthem, Rock and Footy. Michael is one of Australia's most highly acclaimed performers, composers, and record producers. As a producer, his name can be found on numerous chart-topping albums by such artists as The Seekers, Judith Durham, Gene Pitney, amongst many others. As a performer, he is renowned for his onstage presence and virtuoso guitar skills that continue to wow audiences worldwide. He is one of the country's most respected musicians and composers and has taken home many prestigious music awards. With a string of ARIA number one albums to his production portfolio and a new solo album in the works, he continues to be one of the brightest and dynamic stars on the Australian music scene. Dedicating his time and unique skills to both his own projects and those of emerging artists and established veterans alike. Discussing his journey in the entertainment world and his latest release in 2024, the all-Italian album Ma Finera. Up next on Celeb Savant, we've got Michael Cristiano. Where in the world are you and how are you doing?
Well, first of all, I'm doing very well. Thank you very much, Barrett. Thank you for having me on. Where I am, I'm actually in a town called Geelong, which is an hour out of Melbourne in Victoria, Australia. I'm actually here because I'm performing at the Deakin University graduation ceremonies, which I do every year. I'm the musical director for the university. So I'm actually in my apartment talking to you right now.
Is it a university that provides sort of music courses and those type of courses, or is it a general university?
No, not necessarily. It's a general university, but okay. A wonderful graduation ceremony that includes, the way it works is I come out and I do a 20-minute classical guitar performance, just solo. And then after that, at the end of the actual graduation ceremony, I come out with some backing singers and a didgeridoo player, and we do this great big production number that closes the show for the graduates. And this happens 26 times a year.
And so outside of these 26 performances, do you have any other interactions with the university at all, or it's just that those performances? Not that it's it's a lot, but are there any other things that you do with the university?
Yeah, no, I do. I am included in most of the official PhD functions and things like that.
But
it's performance-based.
Okay. And what do you enjoy about that?
Well, I tell you what I really do enjoy, apart from the fact that I love performing, obviously, and it's such a love of mine, is I love seeing young people graduating and going on to this wonderful life, and doctors, nurses, accountants, biologists, chemists, lawyers, you can imagine. It's great to see these young people just go on and do this incredible stuff.
Okay, so now let's rewind. From what age, whether it was a child or teenager, did you feel cool? You want to be in the music world, the creative world, the entertainment world. And how did that journey progress to where we are today?
I took my first guitar lesson when I was 6 years old. And so as a six-year-old, my hands actually weren't big enough to hold a full-size guitar. So my grandmother bought me a three-quarter guitar. So I started lessons on that. And so I took classical guitar lessons throughout my career. So I'm kind of a bit of an academic. I'm trained musician, so to speak. But even before that time, being 6 years old, my mum and dad always tell the story that even when I was a baby in a pram, whenever they'd walk me past a music shop and I saw a guitar in there, I'd be screaming that I wanted it. So something was there from the beginning. My dad, I have Italian heritage. My father used to sing these, he had a beautiful tenor voice, and he used to sing these beautiful Neapolitan songs, and he could play a little bit of guitar in the house. So I was always surrounded by these incredible melodies and music. So I think that just was instilled in me.
And what were the next steps? So you started doing guitar lessons.
So, and of course, I started writing songs when I was about 10 years old. When I was, I think I was 12 years old, I formed my first band with some of my schoolmates, and that was called Rebel.
Okay.
And that was like a rock and roll band. And we rehearsed for 2 years, didn't really do many gigs. And I realized we weren't gigging, so I changed the name to Seventh Avenue because I thought that was more appropriate to getting dances and corporate shows, which actually worked out fine. And so I was 13 then. The keyboard player was old enough to drive, so he would drive us to the shows. And we started doing gigs together. And so that was my first band. And because I could read, I was a reading guitar player. By the time I was 15, I was doing sessions in studios, and my dad would drop me off and playing in shows and stuff like that. And until I could drive, when I was 18, my dad used to drop me off at these shows so I could play. And most of the time, age, so probably shouldn't have been there in the first place. But then after that, I started working in studios. I got my dad to buy me a little studio set up where I could record demos and stuff at home. And then during this time, I was playing with a lot of very well-known artists that were touring Australia. Because I could read, so I'd be called in to back these shows. And what would normally happen in a cabaret setting, let's say, is that you'd have the band that I was in would do the first set. And so I would usually be the singer up because I can sing. So I would usually be the singer up the front, and we'd open the show. And then they'd have the artist that would have come from overseas or wherever do their show. And so it would go like that. And so I did that for a few years until in my 21, I think it was, I was asked to play with the Seekers. And I'm not sure whether your audience would know who that. They're probably one of Australia's greatest musical exports.
Yeah.
And I started playing guitar with them back in 98, I think, or 88, sorry. And then not long after that, I was asked to be their musical director and their record producer. And so I became a producer from 92 until now. I still produce all their albums. And, so that was a great thing for me to do. And, of course, that went on to me producing many, many other artists and writing many songs. And here I am.
So the Seekers are obviously still going and performing.
Well, they are. Judith passed away, so unfortunately the Seekers aren't a going concern anymore, but they have so much archival material.
Yeah.
And so there's still material being released. And, of course, because I'm their producer and musical director, I'm on top of all their whatever creative musical things they do, I'm usually all over it. So, yes. Okay.
When you're creating a song,
yes,
or writing a song, yes, do you know this is going to be a song for someone else, or it's going to be for you, or you just write it and let it unfold as it's going to be, as it comes to life?
If I'm writing, usually it comes from some sort of inspiration, and it could be anything from a title or something somebody says or a melody that comes to me in my head. Those things, that's when it gets very creative, and, of course, I love that inspiration. But having said that, quite often I'm commissioned to write something for somebody. In that case, if an artist particularly wants something, then, of course, you will try and fit that song or that style for that to that artist. And that does happen as well. And it's a totally different process. The two are very different because when you're writing for somebody else, you kind of feel like there are certain barriers because you have to make it fit her or his style. Whereas if you're just writing a song because you're inspired to write a song, it's kind of a different vibe, yeah.
So is that sometimes challenging when you're writing for others and you've been commissioned to do so because you reference there these barriers to allow it to be for them? So do you find that more challenging than writing for yourself, or is it just a different approach?
No, I do find it more challenging. It depends. If sometimes you'll be asked to write something, let's say for a movie, that's kind of a little bit easier because you're given the script and you kind of have an idea of what the pictures are and you pretty much know where you're going. But if you know an artist is looking for a song, that's a little bit more difficult because you don't really know what the artist has in mind. All you can go on is what they've recorded before. And quite often, what happens in your mind is, what if that's not what they want to do anymore? How far can I push this person? I mean, if you're working with someone that's always sung ballads, I like to really shake it up sometimes. And I say to myself, well, why can't he or she do something that kind of really rocks? Let's throw. Sometimes that falls over and it's a total disaster, but sometimes it works. So it is a little bit more difficult, yes.
When you're writing songs for another artist, you already said that you've commissioned, first question is who commissions you, and how much interaction do you have with the actual artist, if at all or any?
It works two ways. Sometimes, this is not always the case, but sometimes the artist you do know is looking for songs, and sometimes they will approach you because they've heard something you've written before that they really like the style of. Sometimes the artist will stay out of the process totally and let you submit a song. Quite oftentimes, though, they will want to be involved in the process. Other times, I will hear from my publishers or my management or something that there is an artist recording an album and he or she's looking for a song. And do you want to submit something? In which case, you either have, we as songwriters, we have a bag, most of us, I hope, would like to say, have a bag. And sometimes you can draw into this bag and find something that might suit this person. And if not, then you just have to go, wow, I just got to write something and try and get it on there, and so that's how it works. It's not a precise science, if you know what I mean. You might think you've written the best song in the whole world, and of course, everyone's going to go, "Oh my God, it's terrible." So it's a strange business we're in, that's for sure.
So when you hear some that type of feedback for a song you thought was fantastic, do you think, okay, cool, the song is now terrible and throw it away? Do you tweak it, or do you just ignore those negative feedbacks coming through?
No, I don't do that anymore. I think I've been doing it long enough to know when something is really good. I'm also part of a record label that's based in Australia, and I've been in the position of being like an artist and repertoire A&R person for a long, long time with different labels, because I'm a record producer. So I get sent songs all the time, and 99% of the time they're not very good, but I know why they're not very good. 1% of the time you'll get something that's just magical. But what I have learned is, just because I think it's not very good does not necessarily mean that someone else doesn't think so. Because, like all art, as you would know better than anyone, it is so subjective.
Of course, yes.
But I do know when something just does not have that thing. And so I think as a songwriter, as a composer, if I get something to the point where I feel like I'm comfortable enough to submit it, be sure it's okay. And so if the artist doesn't like it, then I'll usually take it back and present it to someone else.
I know it's, again, maybe it's a subjective thing. But what is that thing in you that recognizes a song is part of that 1% that's great and the other 99% that it's not so great?
It's a hard thing to quantify, it's a combination of, to me especially, is a combination of a great melody. Rhythmically, it has to kind of work as well, and I think that lyrically, it has to say something or has to touch you some way. And sometimes it can be the most, sugar and pop song, but something about it kind of touches you. Something about it changes the neurons in your brain in a way that you go, "Wow, I can't get that out of my head." Or, if it's a love song, "Wow, that's made me remember when this girl broke my heart." Or it has a catchy chorus that makes you want to sing it, or it's got a great, it just sometimes things just sound really good. I wish I knew why that is. if I knew that, we'd all be writing hit songs every day. Interestingly enough, you'll know when it's not that. You're pretty obvious when you go, oh, my gosh, this is just not going to work.
Okay.
And, yeah, it's pretty obvious.
So when you said that one thing, can't get it out of my head, I went straight to one of your fellow colleagues in the world, Kylie, because I was like, because Kylie's one of my favorites. So, and that's actually the ringtone on my cell phone.
Look, I first worked with Kylie. So Kylie and her sister, Danny,
Yes, I love Danny as well, yeah.
Yeah, were part of a talent show in Australia called Young Talent Time. And back when I was a very young session player, I used to play on the recording sessions for that show.
Oh, wow. Okay.
We all go back a long, long, long way. But Kylie's just a fantastic Australian export, that's for sure.
Absolutely. Okay, now let's bring the focus back to you. What percentage of your time is creating for yourself, releasing for yourself, producing, writing for others? Is it 50-50%, or how does do you let the energy flow as it's happening in your world?
You know what? That's a very good question. And there's been a change in the percentage that you're speaking about of late, because I've spent most of my career producing and writing for others, kind of what I've done. So there's been, I've always tried to do things myself, but obviously when you've got all these projects slated for different artists, you have to do the work. But of late, over the past few years, and especially since 2020, after the pandemic, let's say, I've really been concentrating on myself a lot more, to the point where I've decided to release an album of songs that I've written with a friend of mine in Italian, because I'm Italian heritage, and these are all original songs, contemporary, kind of adult contemporary kind of rock songs that I've recorded, and I'm releasing an album. Three of the songs have already been released. It kind of harks back to, my dad. My dad's gone, so this is kind of a thing for him I'm doing. Yeah. And so I've really been concentrating these past few years on releasing more stuff myself, which I'm really happy to have done that. I'm still producing other artists, but these days, from, say, being 70% producing other people to 30% me, it's now gone the other way. It's been fantastic.
What was the thing in you that was like, okay, now I want to focus more on myself? Was it any specific thing that happened in the world, in your life? I know you mentioned it was since the pandemic. So was that a kickstarter for you, or it was just a simple transition?
Look, I've spent years and years where people have, seen me perform or heard some of the other things that I've recorded, let's say in the past, and they've gone, you need to do an album. The past few years I've been quite successful, and I've produced like 7 or 8 number one albums in Australia in a row, and which is wonderful for me and wonderful for the record label and wonderful for the artist. But everyone says to me, when are you going to do something for yourself? It's this kind of thing. And so for some reason, it all kind of, the stars aligned and it all came together around 2019, 2020. And I called a friend of mine. Her name's Raffaella Fox, an Italian lyricist. She's so brilliant. And we started collaborating. She would send me these beautiful lyrics and I would put the music together and I'd produce these songs and they just kept flowing out. So I ran with it. And it's been just a wonderful experience for me.
Besides the tribute to your dad, what was the other reasons for you to record the album in Italian?
I was born in Australia, but both my parents are from southern Italy, and we always had a strong Italian kind of culture in the family anyway. And I've always been drawn to the country. I mean, I'm a pure-blood Italian man, and I've kind of always felt that in my heart. I always felt that I've had like 1 foot in Australia, 1 foot in Italy. Mm-hmm. I could speak fluently, so I'm really lucky that way. There is something, I must say, what's very important, I think, is there is something about singing in Italian that's different than singing in English.
Okay.
I bring a different sentiment. It makes me feel different. Something really magical happens when I do that. And I feel very comfortable when I sing in Italian, and I I told someone the other day, you know, we're talking about our cultural differences, and I said to them, you know, I've worked this out. When I actually think about things, I actually think in Italian. I don't think in English. And yeah, she didn't really understand what I meant, but I explained it to her. And I just said, you know, your culture is so strong that it changes the way you kind of approach problems and stuff like that. And I realized just how Italian I was. And I think I'm embracing it more and more as I get older.
Okay, that's interesting. Now, I love me a CD. I still budget for my CDs every month. I love the aesthetic of the choice, the receiving, the unpacking, the booklet, the listening from song one to whatever number. I'm sure you're aware, being in the record labels, the increase and rise of physicals. I mean, last year in the UK alone, 5.9 million vinyl sold, the biggest since 1990. In the UK as well, there's a basket of goods that they utilize or track for tax purposes. Vinyls have always been in there, but now because of the upsurge of CDs again, CDs are back in that basket of products. And the research is showing it's all the teenagers, the young teenagers, early 20s, who are like, oh, I want to experience something physical and not have everything on my phone. But then we've also got these streaming platforms that people consume music on. Your observations of the landscape at the moment?
Well, I have to be really honest with you. I mean, I love the physical product, always will. And as much as we have to embrace what's happening in the digital world, I don't think it's anywhere near as rich as beautiful as, you know, I mean, LPs, gosh, I love them so much. And you're right. Everything that comes out on LP in Australia just sells out straight away. People are starting to buy CDs again. All that stuff is happening. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Yes, we both say thank you to all the listeners.
I have a theory about that. I think we've made it a little bit almost too accessible, to the point where it's actually watered down the art a little bit. And it's become, you know, I think we have so many things now that we can access so quickly that sometimes people forget how much work and how much blood, sweat and tears it goes into a work. They actually forget it. They don't care. And so, you know, streaming's become very difficult for any artist to maintain a career anymore anyway. And, you know, I'm not sure what it's like over in Europe or over in, you know, where you are in South Africa, all that sort of stuff. I'm not sure what happens in a live show, but in Australia, really, at a live show is the only place where people can buy a physical product these days. Because even some of our major retail stores are closing down. Now, I think that's changing very, very slowly because, as you say, young people are realizing the importance of having a physical product. And I'm hoping it goes that way. I'd like to see a world where perhaps we can have a lovely balance of both.
Interesting. South Africa, we haven't had so there's a couple of small independent, I can think of two that sell vinyls, but like a chain retail store, like we in South Africa, we used to have a retail store called Musica. And another one called Look and Listen. They all closed down about 6-7 years ago. So we have not had any access to that type of thing for longest time. So the only way for us to get CDs and stuff is to order them through those stores that sell it or through Amazon. But from my side, I stopped getting from the retailer for a long time ago because a lot of times these days, artists will release the normal CD and then the deluxe edition, which will have some remixes and other songs, et cetera, et cetera. And in South Africa, at the stores, they only ever release the ones, the normal ones with the 10, you know, the 10 songs. And if I'm going to pay the money, I want the deluxe song with all the remixes and extras.
So for the longest time, I was ordering them from Amazon in any case. I saw that in London, that HMV store on Oxford Street, that massive store, it's originally closed down. But because of all the need and demand, that store has now opened up again. So there's this nice thing that's happening of stores opening again. And, well, it looks like hopefully that things will balance out, as you said.
Well, I'd like to think so, because I think what the younger generation have forgotten sometimes is that, like I said, the amount of work that goes into producing an album, whether it be an LP or a CD, and the amount of thought that goes into the song order, you know, there's a reason why you put the songs in that order, because you want people to have a experience. It's a whole experience. Yeah. It's like, you know, Dark Side of the Moon, Pink Floyd would not be what it is if you don't listen to the whole thing right through. Exactly. It's a whole experience. And I think that young people these days don't get that anymore, because everything's just, well, let's listen to this song, it's on a playlist, and then something else comes on, and that's all great, but I don't think you get the experience anymore. Exactly. And so it becomes a bit cheaper.
I think it's a lot cheaper, not a bit cheaper. So I'm a passionate music listener, and I've been for the longest time. I often ask people what's their favorite song, and 8, 9 times out of 10, they don't even know who the singer of the song is, or what other songs that they have in their repertoire. Or I'll say to them, I'm going to be interviewing so-and-so, and they're like, who's that? So I play them a couple of songs of that person, they're like, oh, I know that person. For me, I find that weird.
Yeah. It's a different time.
Yes, totally agree. So now, you mentioned earlier that you've released a couple of songs from the album. What's coming up next, the rest of the year, coming up next year? Tell us everything.
So, yes, so the album gets released in November. So 3 singles have already been released. They're doing very well. So I'm very thankful for everyone out there that's listened to them. The album gets released in November. Then there'll be a record launch not long after that. And then hopefully some shows and touring next year. I'm hoping to get to Italy or Europe at least and do some things over there. So that's very exciting. And in the meantime, of course, it continues. I've got a couple of albums locked in for production between now and the end of the year, and a lot more composing to do and all the rest of it. So, you know, just making music every day. I've been very, very blessed. I'm very lucky to do this. And thank you.
I love this game. I know if I had to ask you this question in 2 minutes, 5 minutes, 8 years, I know your answer will be different every time because there are millions of them. I recognize that and I understand that. I'm not saying favorite, I'm saying top of mind. But if you had to push play to 5 songs by other artists once we finish this conversation, what would those 5 songs be and by whom?
Okay. I hope I'm not showing my age. But 5 songs that touch me, I think, would have to be Somewhere Over the Rainbow. I do a classical guitar version of that, and every time I do that, it's just a melody that's always, always struck me. Steely Dan's Gaucho is my alarm tone. Now it's getting hard. Because I'm a jazz nut, Pat Metheny's Bright Size Life, I think he redesigned the jazz guitar landscape when he came out with that incredible album. I'll stay on the jazz thing because that's kind of what I grew up with. I think Aldo Meola's album, Elegant Gypsy, was something that changed me as a young guitar player, because I'd never heard anyone play like that and still haven't to this day. I think one of the other things I've always loved is Whitney Houston's I'll Always Love You. I think it's just an incredible vocal. I'm a big David Foster fan. And the other one I really love a lot is Caruso, which is Lucio Dalla's version of that. And, of course, being Andrea Bocelli and Pavarotti. And that goes back to my Italian roots, and I think it's just one of the most beautiful. You know, it's a Neapolitan. You know, the Neapolitan songs, of course, are some of the most beautiful in Italy, and that's the one I love. Every time I hear that, it touches me in a way.
So the podcast is listened to throughout the world. So as a final message, what would you like to say?
What I'd like to say is thank you to everyone for listening in. And I hope you keep supporting both live music, but also buy the CD, buy the vinyl, because it really does help the artists. And it's very important to keep these people performing and writing. And we need your help.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Celeb Savant. Please follow Barrett on TikTok, Instagram, YouTube, and Facebook at Celeb Savant. That's CelebSavant.